You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Well, James Randi has an international reputation as a magician and escape artist, but today he is best known as the world's most tireless investigator and demystifier of paranormal and pseudoscientific claims. James has pursued psychic spoonbenders, exposed the dirty tricks of faith healers. Can I just say amen to that? Investigated homeopathic water. Sorry, that's homeopathic water. Water with a memory, and generally been a thorn in the sides of those who try to pull the wool over the public's eyes in the name of the supernatural. And he joins us today on The Drew Marshall Show, the one and only James Randi. It is an honor to have you on the show, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall, and good afternoon.
One of the reasons it's an honor is because you were on my favorite talk show ever. You were on the Johnny Carson show. You were with Johnny Carson. How amazing was that?
I think it was 22 times altogether, yes, over the years.
22 times. Wow. Well, thank you for doing what you do. Especially, can you just concisely help our people understand how you brought to light the Peter Popoff ridiculousness?
Well, Peter Popoff was getting answers from the powers on high, or so he said, and that God was speaking directly to him, and we rather doubted that. So we went down to see a couple of the performances in various parts of the country. I lecture all over the world, so it takes me around the country a bit here in the U.S. of A. And I saw him at a couple of performances, and I said to my folks, I said, I think he's using some sort of a communication device. So we got a friend of ours, Alec Jason, who was a private investigator, a PI. We asked him to go into an auditorium, I believe it was in San Francisco first. He went in there and he had all kinds of IDs strapped around his neck. And the guards, when they saw him coming, they just gave a great sigh and looked at one piece of ID and then just waved him on because they were bored, as often guards can get. And he passed by without any trouble at all, and he had with him, he was wearing headphones, and they thought he was listening to an iPod or some such thing. And in reality, what he was doing was he was scanning the different wavelengths. He was using a field strength meter, and that fans the different wavelengths that can be used. And he came upon one which was very loud and clear, and had a woman's voice on it. It turned out to be Mrs. Popoff, who was saying to her husband, and we have the original recording, it's rather cute, "Hello, Penny, this is your wife, can you hear me? If you can't, you're in trouble." And that's exactly what she said. That's a pretty good imitation.
That was very good. I heard it myself. You nailed that one, actually.
Oh, did I?
Yeah,
that
was very good.
Well, in any case, we had intercepted Mrs. Popoff at 107.3 or something megahertz. I've forgotten what the frequency was, but who cares?
Yeah.
In any case, it wasn't heaven that was talking.
No.
It was Mrs. Popoff backstage.
Yes. Well, if it was heaven, it would have been 77.7.
Of course. Of course, we know that.
Yeah.
In any case, we went back the next night, and this time Alec had a recording system with him, and that was also disguised as a sort of a giant iPod thing around his neck, and he appeared to be trucking on down there listening to music or whatever, and he was actually recording Mrs. Popoff. And we eventually, I was due to do a Carson show, and I showed up in Los Angeles, and I went over to see Johnny's producer. I can't think of his name. In any case, now deceased, as is Johnny, unfortunately for us all.
Mm.
And I went to Fred DeCordova, and went over to see him in his office, and he said, "Oh, you're doing the show tonight?" I said, "Yes." And I gave him this bit of a recording, you see, and he played the video. He turned around with his mouth open and said, "Oh, my, this is dynamite." He said, "I'll phone Johnny." And I said, "Wait, hold it. Don't tell John." He said, "But no, Johnny doesn't like surprises." And I said, "I think he'll like this surprise, and I think you'll like it even better than he does, because I want to see the expression on his face." Well, it was worthwhile doing, because Fred said to me, "Hey, it's on your head, you see, and you're responsible." I said, "I'll take the responsibility." Well, it worked out very well.
Yeah.
Because what actually happened on the broadcast, it's up on YouTube someplace, I'm sure, and Johnny was quite surprised by it, because he didn't realize what the punchline was, that Popoff was actually in touch with his wife backstage. And when we played the second version of the tape that had that audio on it, he let out an expletive, let's put it that way. And it was, oh, and it began with S.
Wow.
And the audience all heard it, and they roared with laughter, of course. Well, fortunately, the audience was on a different recording system than Johnny was, and I at the podium, you see.
Yeah.
And they had a chance to edit out the expression where Johnny waved his hands and tried to quiet them down, and they signified to the audience that they shouldn't have laughed at that point. The edited version that you hear eventually, you don't hear hear the crowd sort of tittering in the background, but you don't hear the roar of laughter that came out because Johnny apologized to the audience before they left afterwards. So when the tape was finished,
but that was
so I'm awfully sorry.
That was pretty much the end of Mr. Popoff, though, was it not?
Oh, it was indeed, except that 15 days later he was back with a different name. He was calling himself still Peter Popoff, but instead of Peter Popoff Ministries, he was People United for Christ. He changed the name of the organization, and the other organization went out of business. He continued right on as he was before.
Unbelievable.
He retired temporarily. He sort of went off the air, so to speak, and his broadcasts were no longer broadcast for about 6 or 8 weeks. And then he's back, and he's back very strong. As a matter of fact, the latest report, because he's a 501c3 charity, as you
yes.
can imagine.
Yeah, I can imagine.
The charity that benefits from it is called Peter Popoff, I believe, and his family. So what happened was that he went out of business, technically, so he had to make, naturally, had to make reports to the IRS. The latest IRS report from 2008 says that he made $10 million more than he made the year that we exposed him on Carson.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
No, it's unbelievable when you're in my business.
Seriously. All right. Let's talk about the time that you consulted the Johnny Carson gang prior to them having Uri Geller on the show. That turned into quite a fiasco for Mr. Geller.
Yeah, well, it turns out, you see, I found out that when Geller was at his prime and he was on every
talk show,
yeah, all the time. What would happen is the phone would ring, and I'd at my residence in New Jersey at the time, and I would go to the phone, I'd pick it up, and I'd just hear a click on the other end, a wrong number, you would think. But I realized it was always a few minutes before the half hour or before the hour. And so I tracked back, and it turned out these calls were from Geller or from someone in Geller's milieu at that time in the same city of a program that he was just about to appear on, because he wanted to make sure that I was at my home in New Jersey.
Not at the
not
set where he was going.
Corner or backstage or something like that. So I got called by the Carson show, and they said, well, can you come rushing in? I said, well, first of all, I can't. I'm going to be in the air at that moment. I've got an important lecture date, I said, but because they record in the afternoon on the show, of course. And so I said, I'll probably get that phone call, but I'll be someplace else, and I won't hear it. I said, however, I can prepare your people and yourself on how to put a kink in the thing, if it's a trick. And, of course, it's a simple sleight-of-hand trick.
Sure.
And
he wasn't feeling the vibe that day. He ended up that he just flat-out couldn't do the magic.
That's right. He declined to do his act, you see. For the first time in history at that time, he declined to do the act because he found out that his assistant, who now is his brother-in-law, Shippy Strang, was not allowed backstage. And when he tried to make inquiries about, will you show me the spoons that we're going to use? You know, I want to make sure that they're sufficient. Oh, they're very good, Mr. Geller. I assure you they're the best stainless steel spoons you can buy.
Right, right.
And Geller was not happy with that because, of course, he had to get to them in advance and prepare them so they would bend or break. And so he went on the show knowing that he was messed up already before he got there.
Wow, wow.
And that's why he was on with Fernando Lamas, I think, at the same time. And Lamas was a great believer in him. Oh, yes, he endorsed him 100%. But he was a little puzzled when Geller suddenly failed on national television. Of course, Geller said that, as always said and still says, that I'm his greatest publicist. I think he could do without that kind of publicist.
Yeah, that's right. When you busted Popoff, people still believed in him. When you busted Geller, people still believe. What is with us?
Well, it's a case of you can't tell anybody anything if it's a favored notion of theirs.
Right.
And we even spoke to people in New York City on some ABC network show, I've forgotten what it was, we were recording backstage at W.F. Grant, who was an evangelist like Popoff.
Yeah.
He was in the auditorium, and we approached a woman who had gotten up out of a wheelchair on stage and walked and then danced around and carried on, and she said she had been crippled before that. Well, that looked like a great healing, you see, and Popoff, or pardon me, Grant was very happy with that. But we found her afterwards in the audience as they were leaving and interviewed her and said, but you didn't bring that wheelchair. Oh, no, he gave me the wheelchair because he said if I was in a wheelchair, then he'd know that I needed healing. See, that's one of the gimmicks that they use at the evangelical meetings when they do these things. They put them in wheelchairs whether they need them or not. And I said, but don't you think that's dishonest? And she paused for a minute. She said, well, yes, maybe a little bit, but I still believe.
It is.
He walked away.
It is phenomenal. The mentality of the sheep. You know, they've never been the most intelligent creatures in the universe. So, let's talk about the psychic stuff because we have a psychic in studio here with us. Not comfortable using that term. She's more using the terms intuitive.
Intuitive, yes.
Yeah, sure. And of course, you know, outsiders. I'm new to this whole thing, so I questioned her. I said to her, "Come on, you're just using nicer words so people don't get." You know, they don't think you're some Jerry Springer act kind of thing. But do you believe that people have intuition or that they have more of an intuitive spirit than maybe other people?
Well, you have intuition based upon your previous experience and the hardwiring that's already in your brain.
Right.
You know, if you hear a noise in the dark, you jump. You don't have to be taught that as a child. Hear a noise in the dark here, you should be very careful and you should run. No, that's all hardwired into our brains already. Intuition is usually largely based upon past experience. There's nothing wrong with intuition, but the fact that they give the name intuition to what they then demonstrate as so-called psychic powers is clever. It's a clever dodge, I can assure you of that.
So how would you dispel the powers of a psychic? Somebody in our listening audience today is sitting there saying, you know, as a matter of fact, we had someone call and say they wanted Kate's number, how to get a hold of Kate. That's our lady who's visiting us today with the intuitive powers or the psychic powers, whatever. And, okay, we're going to go see her. We're going to go see person X. We're going to go see person Y. We're going to go see the lady that's on the Montel show all the time, whatever. We want to go get a reading. What would you say to those people?
Well, we don't dispel these things. We don't debunk them because that means you go into the thing with the attitude in advance. This is not true, and I'm going to show you that it's not true. But a scientific attitude says, I don't know. Let's find out. So what we do is we offer $1 million prize through the James Randi Educational Foundation. Now, it's denied, of course, that we have $1 million, but people can easily fax us, can phone us, they can email us, and we will send them a copy from Goldman Sachs of the current account balance, which at this moment is $1.14 million. So it's a little better than we might have expected.
Hmm.
And people, nobody... No one has ever asked to see that evidence. But they go on spouting, say, oh, no, the prize is not real. It's not there. He doesn't have $1 million, et cetera. They continually say this. Now, what we do is we don't debunk them. We simply ask them to prove their case. And if they prove their case, they get $1 million. It's all on our website.
And how does someone prove their case? How would a psychic prove to you that they are indeed a psychic?
They have to first say three things in their application. What they can do. Under what circumstances, with what accuracy. That's all. Those three things. And most of them have a very hard time making that simple kind of a statement. What do you do, with what accuracy, and under what conditions? It's a very simple three-way statement they have to make, and most of them can't even make that, so they drop out of application.
So, Mr. Randi, have you ever had someone, a psychic, do, say, a reading on you, and maybe they've been incredibly accurate, and you've sat there and said, wow, how in the world did you know that?
Well, the first part is true. Some of them are incredibly accurate. But you see, I have a little bit of a trap that I lay for them, and I'll expose this on your program. And all the things like who's who in literature, all these various biographical dictionaries all over the world, in England and in Australia and whatnot, I have the last name of last maiden name of my mother different in every one of them. So when they come up and they say, you have a have a relative. She was named Marie, and they go into their thing, and I say, "Oh, you were reading Cambridge Men of Achievement, were you?" And they look at you blankly because we know where we got the information. So I've supplied some wrong information to these biographical dictionaries all over the world for that very purpose, and you trapped a number of them with that because the actual name of my mother is not listed in any of those.
Right, so you purposely put out misinformation to find out that these people are simply doing their research to find out stuff about you before they have a chat with you.
Yes, because you go on Google, as we know, Google knows everything.
Yeah.
If you do that, you can get enormous amounts of information. And that's what they're doing these days, too. Though they're really commercial, professional ones. People like John Edwards and that sort of thing, they have a vast system there. As soon as a name is announced, it goes into Google, and they can come up with some information if they can get the city and such. And all kinds of information is there. If they've ever been in the news, they've had a divorce or a scandal of any kind or a robbery, anything like that, they can find that information. And, of course, they hint at it, and the person looks a little sheepish and figuring that John Edward has come through with something psychic.
Right. Okay, well, I want to just bring in Kate here. Kate, this is James Randi. James Randi, this is Kate. Hello to each other.
How do you do, Kate?
Hi, James.
So, Kate, you've been hearing Mr. Randi, and you know a little bit about him. And I got to say, Mr. Randi, I've not interviewed you before, and I didn't know what to expect. And sometimes when we have people on who have as a vocation sort of challenging others in what they believe or how they do what they do, sometimes they can be a cantankerous jerk, and you are not such. I admire the way you've come across today. You don't need my approval, but I just want to say thank you for doing what you do, especially from my point of view in the faith healing industry, because I particularly have a hard time with that nonsense. I do believe that there is a God. I know you and I think we differ on that. Is that right, Mr. Randi?
We do indeed.
Yes. So I do believe there is a God, and I still think that God can do great things with individual people. We differ on that. But I'm new to this psychic world. I've not immersed myself in it or studied it or spoken with many or maybe never a psychic over my lifetime. So Kate is a first person for me to be on the show, and we've had a lovely chat about this, but I've been watching her as you've been talking, and I have to ask you, Kate, is there, you know, what's going through your mind as we're talking with Mr. Randi? How do you feel about this?
Well, first I want to say thank you, because I think that some of the debunking has to be done, and I'm really glad to hear that Randy's doing this, that James is doing this. I'm just wondering about, basically the experiment you just described, James, is great for catching psychics who are fraudulent, but for ones who are actually legitimate, it's not a great way to test their accuracy. And I would be happy to set up a whole bunch of experiments with you to be able to accurately test real psychics, whether they're ethical, not ethical, whether they're accurate, not accurate, what their particular strengths and weaknesses are. But you actually have to know a bit more about this field to be able to set up really good accurate tests.
Of course, yes, and we do that. We go into it in detail. We ask them what you can do, etc., and they have to describe it in detail, and they devise the test. We don't devise the test at all, because they know what they're supposed to be able to do. I wouldn't step up to a man in the street and say, "Here's a piano, play Rachmaninoff on this piano." "Oh, I don't play the piano." "Wait a minute, what kind of a person are you?" No, we have to ask them what they can do under what circumstances, and we get that decision, and we design a protocol mutually as to what the experiment will be. And the people, we've had over 400 of them now that are all in our files and all published, and so far we haven't given away 5 cents. But that doesn't mean that we have proven that psychic powers don't exist, by the way. Of course not. That would not be totally illogical. What we have shown is that of the 400 people, of the tens of thousands of so-called psychics all around the world who have actually come to us and tried for the $1 million prize, none of them has been successful. That's the only point that we've made.
I have to ask, what's your definition of successful?
Well, it depends on what you say is successful.
Right.
You know,
so go ahead.
So if you say you can guess somebody's name, if you're given 400 guesses, I think you'd probably be successful at that. But what are the chances? We have to work out the protocol, what the statistics are, for example.
So, see, that's the thing. I, in my practice, I don't consider that successful. I mean, it's important. It's just one of the smaller skills of doing my job properly is to be accurate. But that's not the measure of success for me. At the end of the day, if I can guess every single factual point correctly, but I haven't actually helped my client with anything, then what good does it? It's just it's been. I've reduced what my work to a parlor
well,
trick.
Let me interject here in a second. James, or sorry, I should probably call you Mr. Randy. You certainly have earned the respect.
No,
okay. Kate, when she came into the studio, I said, well, you know, do your stuff, or, you know, what do you pick up on in me? And she said some things, and they were very, very accurate. And as I reflected on where she might have got that accuracy from with a pessimistic mind that I have, I said to her, you know, you could have gone to this website or that website and checked out this, that, and the other thing and maybe got some of the details. But to come to the conclusions that you came to, or that I've been thinking about this or thinking about that, she was accurate, so I would sit here and go, well, wow, that's interesting. Where did that come from? And I know enough about people to say she either had to spend about 12 hours between yesterday and today, I guess, doing research on who I am, and still for her to come to an accurate conclusion that she did today, there's a bit of spook factor in there, Mr. Randy. I don't know what to do about that.
Well, if you had a recording of it, we could do an analysis of it, but unfortunately you don't have a recording.
No, no, I do. I recorded the show today.
Well, no, I'm talking about what you spoke to Kate earlier.
Yeah, we have that recorded. I don't have it for you right now, but we have recorded the show today, yeah.
Oh, well, I'd like you, if you would be so kind, perhaps send me a cassette of that or a recording or over the Internet or whatever.
Sure.
And I could do a small analysis of it, and we'll find out what can be determined and what is correct beyond chance alone. You know, you're a generous person. You've always been generous, but sometimes you've had to withhold that generosity because of your wisdom, and you have deep wisdom about the this kind of thing goes on forever, you see. And you're also a person who likes to hear the truth. Now, not if it's nasty or if it involves friends of yours, but basically, you're a truthful person. And this kind of reading is so general.
Right. It's kind of like it's kind of like the horoscopes you read in the paper every day. And as long as there's a bit of stroking involved and a bit of generalities, then we're good
That's
to
right.
go. Right.
But as a matter of fact, we have several, many recordings and video, pardon me, and audio tapes in cassette form that Sylvia Brown has given to her clients. And we have actually done experiments where we've played these recordings for people who believe that Sylvia Brown has the powers. And we said, we called Sylvia Brown, we gave her all your particulars, your name and your address and such. This is what she came up with. And they sit there and they nod and they say, oh, that's so true. This is done for another person in another state, in another part of the world, who is not related in age differences or anything like that in any way. And these people sit there and nod and smile and say, oh, she's so right, she's so right. And this is a reading for another person.
Right. Have you ever come across where somebody said, you know, in the reading, I challenged Kate about that, not challenged, we talked about this, where, you know, if you had talked about the blue whale that I used to play with as a child in the tub, nobody else knew about the blue whale, it's not out there in Google, you know, what would you do with that information, Mr. Andy?
Well, did she say that?
No.
Oh, I see. Well,
no, but if someone did, I guess hypothetically, have you ever come across that kind of, where someone has said, you know, something so bizarrely accurate and so bizarrely private that you've just sat there and said, wow, that's interesting, we can't do much with that?
No, I've never had the occasion, but I'm prepared for it. You know, if they come up with 600 facts and one of them involves a blue whale that she couldn't possibly have known about, I'd say, well, it's only one in 600 facts, you know, or 600, let's say, hits,
right,
as they refer to them.
Right, right. Kate, you have your eyebrows are doing a strange thing again.
Well, Mr. Randy, though, how if you had to describe somebody that was near and dear to you, what words would you use to describe them? I mean, the terms that you just said, you would have to describe them in similar ways. You'd have to say, well, you know, my cousin Sharon is very generous. She tends to really like animals and small children. Now, that sounds really vague to somebody who doesn't know Sharon, but that's an accurate description of your cousin Sharon, let's say. But if you, if a psychic does it, immediately everybody says, oh, they're just making it up. But how else do you describe people except in people terms, which intrinsically sound vague in the realm of science? It doesn't sound like something you can nail down.
Well said.
But generalities are one thing, but specifics are another. And as specific, like she had a sister who was a suicide. Now, that would be very evidential. Very evidential. And if you say it in a way such, there's someone very close to her, a sister or a brother or someone in her family who had such difficulties that he or she committed suicide. Now, that's a different thing altogether from your sister committed suicide.
I've got information like that.
Have you?
Yeah, I've got information. I had one person who I kept on getting suicide and illness, suicide and illness. And I thought, why am I getting both of these things? And I thought about it, and I waited, and I paused, and I was like, I'm getting information this person died from both at the same time. How can it be both? And then I went, oh, I get it. And then I finally took a moment to process this. Then I spoke out loud to my client. I said, your brother, there was a brother, and I said, your brother drank himself to death, didn't he? And she said, yes, he did. So, I mean, the thing is, I find it hard to believe, actually, not that I don't believe what you're saying, James, but I find it hard to believe that you just haven't found any psychics who are actually proving this to you, because it's really not that hard. Frankly, my contention is that it's much easier. In fact, that could take a complete non-psychic, and if you give me enough time and they're willing, I could train them to the point of being a fairly accurate professional psychic. I think it's much harder to lie. Like, I don't understand why you haven't found anybody. Maybe the variables of your experiments are controlled in such a way that you know, it's sort of determined that everybody's going to fail by your standards.
The variables are decided by the person who's making the claim, not by me, not at all. They decide what test they can pass.
Great science students?
Are they what?
Like, it takes a scientific mind to be able to set up a good experiment. Faulty variables will result in faulty results.
No, you know, if you can play the violin, you can play the violin. That doesn't mean you can play the harmonica, or that you can juggle, or tap dance, or any of these things.
Yeah, but a professional golfer and an amateur golfer are not the same thing. Somebody who does it for entertainment, who goes on the road to show people golfing, opposed to somebody who just golfs a great game privately with his friends, is not the same thing. I'm a really good professional intuitive, but I'm not a performance psychic, which is why it was, you know, nerve-wracking for me to do it on the air.
Yeah,
because I'm not a parlor trick person. I do it in the privacy of my office, confidentially with my client to serve them and with accuracy. But you're sort of making, you know, you're taking a whole bunch of separate things and linking them together in a way that I think is going to monkey up the results of any type of experiment you run.
That is up to the person who's making the claim. I don't design the test. That person designs the test. Now, if you play the violin, you could say, I will take a violin and a bow, and I will play you X, whatever, Summer Breezes, or some tune, or whatever tune you want, I will play that. If you give me the music, I can look at the music and I'll read it. You see, that's a claim. That's a firm claim. And if they can prove that, then I have to say, gee, they can play the violin. Here's the $1 million. Except that we don't give the $1 million for playing the violin.
Well, you guys both, I see, there's a part of me that wants the nutcases out there to be debunked or to be embarrassed or whatever, and I'm all on board with that. But then there's a part of me when I meet someone like Kate, who I've come to appreciate just a little bit here, and I trust her enough to bring her on the show. I don't trust her implicitly because I don't know her enough that way. And I wonder about common ground there. And I really, really am glad that you are out there doing what you're doing, because I think the majority of the population want the whack job stopped. Agreed?
Oh, yes, agreed.
Yeah.
If you would be kind enough to send me a recording of what Kate told you, and tell me a little bit about the circumstances under which she told them, you know.
Sure, sure.
Where was she and that sort of thing. Just briefly,
yeah.
The circumstances. I'd be glad to do an analysis of what she told you, and we'll see how accurate it was.
Sounds good. Okay, just before we go, because we've got to get on to our next guest here, but I want to ask you, yeah, I'm sorry to ask you these questions, because I know you've been asked a million times, so just concisely, how did David Copperfield walk on air across the Grand Canyon, and how did you make the Statue of Liberty disappear?
By secret means that are not going to be revealed.
You can't do that!
Well, yes, I can.
Is this a magician's
David
code?
David Copperfield doesn't claim that he really did it. He claims that he produced the illusion of doing it. He's an illusionist.
Right. Oh, do you know how he did it?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I got to say, I admire you greatly for hanging over Niagara Falls on such a cold, cold winter's day.
Oh, but the money was very fine, Mr.
Oh, you're a champ. Well, listen, thank you. I've got so many more questions. I'd love to have you on again, as I'm sure most talk show hosts would, and you've graced us with your presence today. Mr. Randy, thank you for your time.
It's been a privilege, and thank you very much, Kate.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you go. That was a fascinating discussion, a bit of push and shove and a bit of back and forth. Kate still has that squinched look in her eyes. And, oh, man, I've got so much more I want to say. So well, we might revisit this again in the future. There's enough there that I think, we could see where this is going to go. All right, we're going to move along to our final bit of discussion today. And, folks, there's nothing scarier in this neck of the woods than the H1N1 virus. And this is our Halloween special, and so we've got to talk about it. We've got spooky music and everything, but we've also got a doctor who's been quite involved with high-level H1N1 discussions. He's a member of the National Advisory Committee on Immunization, and he is the Medical Officer of Health with the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority. We're going to ask him some questions, and then if we get time, which I'm not sure we will, oh boy, look at that, we might open up the phone lines and just do a quick survey how many of you are going to get your shot or not. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.